This is Our Anxiety Stories, the Anxiety Canada podcast. This is the place where people from all walks of life share their stories of anxiety and related disorders to remind you that you are not alone. If you have an anxiety story you'd like to share, contact us at anxietycanada.com/Our Anxiety Stories.
Hi, I'm your host, Mark Anchak, RCC and clinical educator, and you're listening to Anxiety Canada's Our Anxiety Stories podcast, the OCD series. Each week, we'll dive into personal stories, expert insights, and practical tips to help you understand and manage OCD. Whether you or someone you love is affected by OCD, this podcast aims to provide support, education, and a sense of community. Join us as we navigate this journey together, one podcast at a time. Today, I'm joined by Dr. Peggy Richter, who's the inaugural head and co-lead of the Frederick W. Thompson Anxiety Disorder Center at Sunnybrook Health Sciences Center, and heads the sole residential treatment program for severe OCD in Canada. She's a professor of psychiatry at the University of Toronto and an associate member of the Sunnybrook Research Institute. Dr. Richter is internationally known for her work in OCD, focusing on exploration of the genetic and biological basis of this illness, novel treatments, and improving treatment outcomes. He is the author of numerous publications and sits on the board of several advocacy groups, including the Scientific Advisory Board and the Perinatal Task Force of the International OCD Foundation and the Canadian Body-Focused Repetitive Behavior Support Network. In addition to being an internationally acclaimed speaker on anxiety, where she presents to both healthcare professionals and lay audiences, Dr. Richter also co-chaired the development of Ontario Quality Standards for Management of OCD and Anxiety Disorders. Welcome, Dr. Richter.
Thank you so much, Mark.
I'm so grateful to be having you here and all of your expertise. It's quite the CV you come from, and obviously you invested a lot of your life in the treatment of OCD. So I guess one of the initial questions that I'd love to open up with is, you have a lot of folks here listening that either have OCD or they think they may have it. At what point would someone consider getting OCD support?
Such a great question. And before I launch into it, I just also want to say thank you to you and Anxiety Canada for doing this. I think it's such a valuable service to people. So you're starting off with a really good initial question, which is, how do you know if you need help and when is it right to get help? And the answer is a pretty straightforward one, I would say, for almost any psychiatric issue, which is, if you are being distressed by thoughts of any sort or intense emotions that seem disproportionate to your circumstances, or having other difficulties with behaviors that are leading to problems with functioning in your life and maintaining relationships and doing well at work or school the way you normally would, that's a signal to get help. So those same general principles apply to OCD. In the case of OCD, my advice would be, anybody who thinks they may have OCD, namely because they have obsessions or intrusive, unwanted, sticky thoughts that seem to persist that they can't somehow move on from, or rituals and compulsions, which are the actions people engage in typically to try and alleviate their concerns. If anybody is troubled by these and it's beginning to interfere with their ability to function or causing them distress, that's a good sign that maybe getting help is a good idea, because nothing is ever harmed by getting some help and getting another opinion.
And a couple of things you mentioned there really stand out. So it sounds like when we have these kind of persistent thoughts that are quite distressing in nature, or when we have a lot of these kind of compulsions that really take up a lot of our time or detract from our quality of life or functioning, is there like a threshold that you kind of need to meet? Or, as you're kind of mentioning, just at any given point, if you feel it's distressing to you, that's the time to get that help?
It's a great question. And ultimately, I would say an individual needs to make that decision for themselves, subjectively, based on how they're feeling. The yardsticks that we use for diagnosis, though, are basically exactly that. We would call somebody as having OCD, being diagnosable with OCD, if they themselves define it as causing them subjective distress. So I'm getting these thoughts. They are upsetting to me. They actually are really quite disturbing. That's enough. If they are interfering with your ability to function in any way, that is enough. Or in the case of OCD, the one little unique option as well is if these symptoms maybe aren't so distressing, maybe aren't really preventing you from doing things normally, but slow you down enough that they may waste an hour a day or so. That would be another threshold we look at for diagnosis.
Okay. Yeah, because we kind of acknowledge that OCD lies on a spectrum. And although there's a lot of chronicity with it, we also know that the main kind of measure is severity, as you had put once. And it really, I think too, I often see a lot of folks come in when they say, you know, I don't think it's bad enough. I don't know if it warrants the support, but what you're advocating for is if it bothers you, if it's distressing, if it meets any of these kind of thresholds, go ahead and get some support.
Exactly.
Yeah. Okay. So let's say someone is kind of at that point. They want to get some support. They want to get some help. Where do they start? What are some of the first steps you can take?
So great question. My usual starting point would be to say, call your family doctor. Now, in Canada, I have to be realistic and recognize that that may not be quite as easy as it used to be. Mm-hmm. But seeing a family physician at a walk-in clinic may also be a good way to get started. Any general physician should be able to recognize the signs and symptoms of OCD and give you at least some guidance around what next steps are. The other thing I can't speak to strongly enough is becoming your own best informant, your own best caregiver by learning about the illness. And that means going to resources. There are some fabulous online resources that will give people a lot of information if they're wondering if what they're dealing with might be OCD. So, for example, websites such as the one run by the International OCD Foundation at iocdf.org has a wealth of information. Similarly, Anxiety Canada at anxietycanada.com has fabulous resources now for the whole spectrum of anxiety disorders, including OCD. And I guess a last resource I'll just highlight, although it is slimmer than the others but has other materials, is our own website at the Thompson Center, which can be found at sunnybrook.ca/Thompson Center, one word, because we also highlight support groups, for example, and list other websites, as well as some of the wonderful self-help books that are out there. And there is a lot of evidence, actually, that for people with mild issues, simply attending self-help books and or what we would call self-help therapy, bibliotherapy, reading about it, may often be enough to help get them on the right path.
Okay, so I'm really hearing almost kind of like a proactive approach where if you even start to kind of notice little whispers of it, being able to take some of that decision-making power in your own hands, looking at some of these resources that we'll certainly share on our link here, that could almost prevent it from getting worse. That could be an early intervention of sorts that prevents it from becoming more severe.
It's a lovely way to put it. And we do know that seeking treatment earlier is always better than later on. Most people will do better the earlier in the course of illness that they seek help.
Mm-hmm. No, such an important point. And I want to go back to this piece around a family physician or like a walk-in doctor. It is true that it is getting increasingly more difficult to find that kind of support. And I've also heard a number of folks that, for example, with specific type of obsessions, for example, one that may be a bit more taboo in nature, often involving either self-harm, harming of others, any kind of paraphilic kind of components. I've heard occasional stories where sometimes clinicians may not be able to recognize that as OCD. Do you kind of have any thoughts on what to share with folks that may be ambivalent to seek out help if they worry about that?
I'm really glad you raised that, and I wish it weren't so, but what you raise is a valid point. And unfortunately, we all hear the occasional really unfortunate story because OCD commonly can involve what we call taboo thoughts. So violent thoughts, images or impulses of stabbing people or other ways of harming people, driving cars into people in traffic, intrusive sexual thoughts that are very disturbing, not pleasurable in any way, whether they involve family members, people of the gender one doesn't view oneself as attracted to, children or other subjects or topics. And what we often call scrupulosity or religiosity, so thoughts about having acted in immoral ways or going against religious beliefs. And these cause tremendous anxiety for good reason. Sometimes people who aren't familiar with OCD may misunderstand them. So having said that, your question is a really important one. And I can't give any one answer beyond this, which is if you have a good relationship with your family physician and you know them to be somebody who is open to mental health, then I advise your listeners to go and just be upfront and ask about it. And a sensitive and reasonably knowledgeable doctor may say, this isn't my expertise, but let's get you seen by somebody who does have that knowledge and refer you on to a psychiatrist. If you don't have that kind of a relationship and you're seeing a doctor for the first time and you are concerned, it is also perhaps a reasonable consideration to talk about other OCD symptoms that are not as likely to be misunderstood, keeping in mind that most people with OCD have multiple types of symptoms. So one could talk about one's checking symptoms, for example, and even, you know, in the case of people whose primary concerns are perhaps around being responsible for harm to others, they may have all kinds of checking rituals they would feel comfortable talking about. I have to check when I drive the car that I didn't hit someone. I have to check that my family members are safe and didn't come to harm. There are lots of other ways of disclosing symptoms without necessarily volunteering those elements and then asking themselves for a referral to a mental health provider who will better understand OCD.
Right. So even just kind of recognizing, even if the nature of my thoughts feels really vulnerable, feels really terrifying to talk about, I can talk about the way that it comes out. So I excessively check, I can't get certain thoughts out of my brain. I feel really stuck. I feel like I lose hours to all of these different kinds of things that I have to do to get relief. Even if they don't know OCD very well, that in and of itself should be at least recognizable or a safer way to share that you're struggling.
I love the way you put that. Exactly.
Yeah. It is unfortunate, right? Because I mean, I hear a lot of these stories, especially kind of more recently, a lot of like moms, for example, like brand new moms. We have a lot of narratives and we have a lot of education on postpartum depression, but like postnatal OCD, as an example, is something that I feel like is becoming more prominent, but is still very much missing. So I'll sometimes get these moms that are having these thoughts about harming their kids in different ways for like a year or a couple of years before they before it becomes severe enough where they seek help for it.
Yes, that is such a vulnerable time in women's life. I mean, I will just as an aside mention, men are also more vulnerable with the arrival of a child. They may not have the biological factors going on that women are experiencing in terms of hormonal and other bodily changes, but the emotional stress of adapting to a new little one for whom you feel responsible is going to be triggering to anybody. And we know that this is among the most common time points in women's lives for OCD to announce itself or to become worse. And usually at that time, the content does revolve around horrible concerns the women have that they will somehow deliberately harm their child or be responsible for harm to the child. Totally understandably, I think most people who have had children can probably relate to some extent to that feeling of, oh my gosh, I am now responsible for this new person. But for people with OCD, it goes above and beyond. And getting help is so important because there is good treatment and this can be helped.
Absolutely. No, such an important message. And truly, I think like even any time that I have someone come in and they share those words for the first time, I'm having thoughts about this really taboo thing. And I say, you know, it kind of sounds like this really is OCD. Oftentimes it's almost like this wave of relief that often is accompanied by like just people crying, just emoting so intensely because of that palpable relief of saying, oh, a professional just told me that this isn't me wanting to do something abhorrent or terrible, you know?
I'd like to follow up on that point and just say,
please.
When we do psychoeducation with patients, to
Mm-hmm.
that point precisely, it's sometimes a huge sigh that you see going through them when I share that, in fact, none of us can control our thoughts, and we all get bizarre, disturbing, sometimes frankly repugnant or inappropriate thoughts. That's the human condition. So people with OCD may be attaching more importance to it. The thoughts may be stickier, but they are thoughts we all get.
Absolutely. Yeah, it's how we make meaning from these very normalized thoughts versus whether we have them at all, because we can't ultimately control them, as you've said. So you mentioned psychoeducation. So kind of segueing into how we're kind of navigating finding a therapist that knows how to educate on OCD, a therapist that knows how to work with OCD, what are some of the things that you can do as someone that's looking for a clinician to basically verify that they're trained in treating it?
That's a great question. So I think it depends on whether we're talking about psychiatrists or other mental health professionals to some extent, in the sense that if medication is somebody's preferred treatment choice at that point, then any psychiatrist, and in fact, in general, any family physician should be familiar with how to initiate the starting medications for OCD, what we would call our first line medications, or those that have the best balance between evidence of benefit and possible adverse events or side effects, which are the SSRI antidepressants, frankly, the selective serotonin reuptake inhibitors, which are the most commonly prescribed antidepressants in any event. Now, if we're talking, however, about psychological therapy, CBT typically being what we call our first line psychological treatment with the strongest evidence by far, then that's where it does get trickier, because it is very reasonable for anyone as a consumer to ensure that their person they're seeing has had specific training in OCD. One of the painful lessons we know from research studies out there is that a very large percentage of mental health practitioners, including psychiatrists who say they do CBT, psychologists, and others, whether they be social workers, nurses, other mental health professionals, if they haven't had treatment specifically in CBT for OCD, we know that generic CBT, the kind of CBT we are generally taught first to be used for depression and to some extent anxiety, is ineffective for OCD. And I want to make sure that was very clear to people. General CBT, not targeting OCD, is ineffective for OCD. So it is really reasonable and important to ask your prospective therapist what experience they've had with OCD. Have they had any specialized training, whether it was during the formal education they had to get their degree, whether it was subsequently as an intern or a practicum or in a work setting where they were supervised specifically with OCD cases? Those are fair questions. And frankly, my own perspective is that if a therapist is uncomfortable answering them, then that to me is a good sign they probably don't have that specialized training. And while they may be wonderful therapists and great people, I will just not feel as confident that they know how to directly target OCD. There is one other thing I will mention, and that is something called the BTTI, the Behavior Therapy Institutes that are run by the International OCD Foundation. These are not essential by any means, but they are one type of educational initiative that has been developed by the major public group that supports people with OCD. And they do a very good job of giving mental health practitioners basic grounding in CBT for OCD. Really a lovely job. They're pretty available. And that would be another type of training people might seek out.
No, such an important point. So I'm hearing just a couple summary points there. So finding a therapist that's willing to even answer the question, here's the kind of experience I had, acknowledging whether or not they're willing to actually talk about the extent of experience they have, how many hours perhaps they've trained in it. The BTTI program, having done a number myself, such a foundational program because it just gives you all of the basics plus some, because there's different levels of it. If memory serves, where you can come at a beginner's level or do more advanced training as a clinician. You mentioned all these different trainings. Would you mind kind of sharing some of the specific modalities that you could even tell folks to look out for? So I'm asking about training. What kind of training do they need specifically besides like the BTTI? What do they teach in that?
So I should also just say there are lots of other groups around the world that offer trainings intermittently or occasionally, and I don't mean in any way to disparage any others. It's just that the BTI has been a steady offering, so it's one easy one to recognize. In terms of what you're looking for somebody who has specific skills in exposure and response prevention as an absolute starting point. That is a form of cognitive behavioral therapy. It actually comes under the B of CBT, standing for the behavioral. It's our basic behavioral approach to OCD. It is evidence-based. It was the first-line treatment to be recognized for OCD. Now, many will also have cognitive therapy training, and usually that is integrated in, and that's when we use that full term CBT. But CBT for OCD typically still includes that exposure and response prevention element, what we consider to be the behavioral therapy part of the treatment. There are lots of other types of psychotherapies, and there is really a lot of interest and research going on into looking at them, but none of the others have attained what we would call first line evidence yet. So, for example, as to name just a few, mindfulness-based cognitive therapy is a very helpful intervention for depression and a host of other issues and has been researched for OCD with good outcomes. There is a newer version of CBT called inference-based CBT, ICBT for short, which has also gained a lot of attention and looks very good. But again, these would not yet be considered first-line treatments.
Okay. Yeah, so we're kind of seeing a little bit of a hierarchy based on the amount of evidence that's been collected, looking at the efficacy rates of how well that modality works. So I'm hearing ask if they have specific training in ERP, asking if they have some training in cognitive components or cognitive work, not general CBT, because that is deemed ineffective for OCD specifically. And if they say they primarily work through things like mindfulness-based cognitive therapy, if they work through things like ICBT or ACT, that they should have some caution because it's not considered first-line treatment at this point.
Exactly. They can be wonderful add-ons, but I would want to be seeing a therapist who was still familiar with the basic CBT approach, who then is able to use some of these other techniques to enhance it.
Okay. Excellent, excellent points. And yeah, I think you see so much of like the trends that happen. You know, like ICBT is really having a moment right now where people are saying it's OCD treatment without the ERP. And there's so many folks, I think you could attest to that don't do therapy because they're so terrified of doing any kind of ERP or any kind of exposure at the end of the day. So acknowledging like that medication piece, because I think that may segue into how challenging it could be to do therapy sometimes. How would you help someone determine whether they are at a point where medication is appropriate? And if so, you've already mentioned a psychiatrist. What can they kind of expect from that?
Okay, such a good question. So I think my first starting point usually would be to say, does the patient have a strong preference? And to explore the reasons why they may have that strong preference to make sure it's based on what we know to be true rather than perhaps some misinformation they picked up from a relative or friend who may have had an unusually difficult experience for some reason with one or the other. So that's my, you know, my first starting point is, did you come in with a specific idea? Because people's preferences are important. Now, having said that, both medication and CBT, as I mentioned before, would be absolutely considered first line based treatments because of the excellent evidence showing that they benefit most people who receive them. They have very significant pros and cons, though, which are things to consider by the individual. So something you mentioned would be many people being somewhat fearful of doing exposure-based work, which, as I mentioned, is the mainstay traditionally of any CBT approach, which incorporates exposure and response prevention. If people are fearful of it, again, I want to go into why and see whether we can work around that. But something to consider is that with medication, people don't need to necessarily begin by challenging their fears at all. With medication, you are taking a pill. That is an easy step for most people. Now, for some people, OCD may get in the way. But generally speaking, taking a pill once a day is not going to be all that challenging. It doesn't involve dealing with heightened levels of anxiety. And medication will be quite effective for the majority of people as long as they appreciate that the first pill alone will very likely not be sufficient, in that only about 50% of people show a good response to the first medication they try. So one of my first bits of information around medication is be patient, be willing to try a few different medications in order to find one that for you specifically has a good balance in terms of helping your OCD and not causing significant side effects that are going to interfere with your quality of life in any way. Another thing about medication that is worth considering is that if people have multiple illnesses that came on with their OCD. So perhaps they have some significant burden of depression. They may have some panic attacks or panic-like episodes when their anxiety is really high and triggered. Perhaps they have another anxiety difficulty in the background that's not as significant, but nonetheless part of that picture. As the presentation gets more challenging in that way, that can also be a reason sometimes why we might favor medication. And certainly if the OCD is very severe in and of itself, in other words, as that burden of illness increases, that's when our emphasis will increasingly be on making sure that we get some medication aboard if the person is willing to consider it, because it may really ease their burden and open the door to more effective psychological treatment.
Right.
On the other side, CBT has some very significant advantages that can't be understated. Number one being that it is the most effective intervention for the majority of people. Some early studies have suggested, and some of the more recent ones as well, support at least 70%, if not 90% of people benefiting from CBT when they actually engage in it and are doing the work. Right. And the work is the second big issue. It's like learning any new skill and learning to think differently. And just as you wouldn't expect to master piano with one lesson a week or become fantastic at hitting home runs in baseball if you only attended a practice once a week, the more you practice, the more you improve. And that means willingness to experience anxiety and face those triggers without doing the rituals. So CBT requires that huge commitment, but the reward is better likelihood of greater benefit and more long-lasting benefits.
So that reduction in potential relapse, unlike meds, for example, really kind of provides you with a skill set that gives you some of those longer or more improved outcomes from the sounds of it.
Absolutely.
Yeah. There's so many folks that I think I'll do an intake with, and, you know, they will have all this motivation. They'll have so much of this like willingness to try and create this change, to try and do the work. And then once we kind of get past the psychoeducation piece, there's a lot of folks that really kind of freeze up, because when they're asked to start ERP, it's just so overwhelming that they cannot even remotely comprehend the concept. And I think in these kinds of instances, the way that I often describe is, you know, Meds are there to kind of reduce the intensity of how those worries impact you. They make the thoughts a little bit less sticky, in a sense. And once they kind of get on some kind of medication that works for them, generally they have more capacity, they have more ability to regulate some of that anxiety so they can utilize the skills and the tools that they learn in therapy.
I couldn't say it better, Mark. Exactly. I think, though, an important point I just want to mention, because sometimes I hear misunderstandings about that, is just to say once again, though, that although for more severe illness, absolutely medication can be crucial in opening the door to allow somebody to really invest in psychological treatment. At the mild to moderate end of the spectrum, many people will do beautifully without medication at all. And so we shouldn't overestimate either the need for it.
Of course. No, absolutely. Such a good point. So just to kind of briefly touch up or add a few more details to the medication piece. So you mentioned SSRIs are kind of like the standard first line for any kind of medication support. Are there additional types of medications that people will sometimes try? Because we know there's a lot of different classifications of medications, and what can folks kind of expect from those?
So there are quite a number of classes, although only the SSRI type of antidepressants are what we call first line. Again, just to come back to it, that's based on a very high level of evidence from many studies which have been looked at in tandem, supporting that the effects are real, typically what we call randomized double-blind controlled studies, where people may be getting a placebo or other control medication to compare it with and don't know in advance what they're getting. So people's expectations, including the doctors who are rating them, don't cloud the findings of the study. So when we have that level of evidence and we know that the drugs are very safe as well as effective, that's when we call them first line. And that is the SSRI group of antidepressants. There are a few other types of antidepressants that also have good evidence, but not quite at the same level or with more side effects. So those include the serotonin and norepinephrine reuptake inhibitors, or SNRIs, as their class is known. And clearly, as you might tell by the title, they overlap in those serotonergic effects, which is one of the brain neurotransmitter systems, as well as also impacting the norepinephrine transmitter system. And these drugs are very safe, good antidepressants, just lower level evidence for OCD. The other type of antidepressants in this group is actually just one unique agent called clomipramine, which is an older type of antidepressant called a tricyclic. It has primarily serotonergic effects, again, and is actually relatively selective for serotonin, but does act on a number of other neurotransmitter systems. Interestingly, that may contribute to some of the benefit people may experience with it, but also does lead to more significant side effects with it. And because of that, even though it's been clearly shown to be extremely effective, we would also call it second line because those side effects can include a host of things, including orthostatic hypotension or dizziness when you stand up too rapidly, significant constipation, significant hesitancy when urinating, and in a very small minority of cases, even a small risk of seizures. So we need to think about it a little more carefully because of that burden. And we typically reserve both the SNRIs and clomipramine until people have tried at least two SSRIs. I think a rule of thumb I'd also like to share is that treating OCD with antidepressants is not the same as treating depression. And there are two distinct rules clients should be aware of, as well as their doctors. And that is that with OCD, while low doses may work, in general, statistically, the best odds of getting a good response are seen with much higher doses. And so for most people, that will mean pushing up the dose if the low doses don't work. So that's number one, higher doses. Rule number two is that it can take much longer to see a response to antidepressants in OCD than for depression. And so a typical drug trial in OCD will require about 3 months of building up the dose and then giving it some time, at least 6 weeks or longer at the maximum dose people tolerate. or their doctor is willing to prescribe that they think will be helpful for their OCD. And that's very different from depression, where often people would switch medications after 6 weeks.
So much nuance there. I'm really hearing that so many of these decisions involve kind of like a cost benefit analysis of, here are the different things that I can benefit from meds, but here are the tangible side effects that we might have to deal with, versus am I willing to kind of push through the initial discomfort in psychotherapy to be able to get the really palpable and tangible effects that come from that. Really such important pieces for folks to consider. And I guess like when we talk about SSRI use, we can maybe start with that one, but can you kind of briefly talk about what folks can expect? You mentioned it can take up to 3 months, so a little bit longer for OCD, but what's the typical kind of trajectory for folks, or what do they experience on any kind of medication?
So typically these medications are really well tolerated, as I mentioned, Mark, and very, very safe, but that doesn't mean they won't have any side effects. So it's pretty typical for people to experience some mild side effects, at least. And those could range between some GI symptoms, such as a mild degree of constipation or nausea, perhaps a bit of a sense of sedation, or in some people's cases, they may feel slightly more wired initially on the medications. And based on that, they may decide to take it morning or night to suit their schedule best. It's not uncommon to have perhaps a bit of a fine tremor, or a little bit of shakiness, or a little increase in sweating. And unfortunately, sexual side effects, although usually mild, are pretty common for most people. So some drop in libido, or slightly more difficulty getting aroused sexually. Okay. These are not permanent. All of these side effects tend to be dose related, and most will get better over time. Now, when people start feeling benefit, typically what they'll experience is a feeling that the intensity of the thoughts has just diminished a bit. So the thoughts are still there. I'm still worried about contamination and germs when I touch these objects, but I found I'm a little more able to move past it. And maybe instead of washing my hands 3 times in a row, I've lately said, oh, I'm in a hurry, I'll just wash them twice, or maybe even once. And then I went on with my day. And that's a real change. So it's not that symptoms disappear for most people, but they will come down in that intensity. And that allows people to begin to challenge and limit them a bit more. And that will take, as I mentioned, anywhere from 6 to 12 weeks typically.
Okay. And so I'm really hearing it makes the thoughts less sticky, no pun intended, if with the contamination component. What would you say to someone who's kind of going through the trial and error of meds? Because I think this is a common issue. It's a common issue for folks when they're struggling to decide, do I need to like push through on this one? Do I need to just stay on this one and see if it gets easier? At what point can folks make the decision to pivot and try something different?
That's a great question. If the side effects are getting in the way of your quality of life, they're unpleasant, they're on your mind or in your body quite a bit of the time, then that to me is more than good enough reason to say this may not be the right fit, particularly if you haven't tried many medications yet. Okay. Now, that equation may begin to change in somebody who's had perhaps 3, 4, 5 medications or more without success. And then people may want to try and persist a little longer, not necessarily pushing the dose up any higher, but keeping it at whatever dose they find is manageable in the hope that, one, the side effects will diminish over time, because they often do, or two, the medication is of so much benefit that it's worth it to them.
Right. Yeah, again, kind of doing that cost benefit analysis again, because I know for a lot of folks, they'll kind of go to their physician, they'll get prescribed a med. And, you know, we typically do see more of that prominence of a side effect initially, and a lot of it subsides. But a lot of folks I find just have a hard time kind of deciding, how hard is it? Like, is it worth staying on this? And that's kind of where I encourage them to go back and reflect and say, you know, is any of the benefit problematic enough, or rather, are any of these side effects rather problematic enough that are impacting your quality of life? kind of going back to that original definition of OCD. Are these thoughts problematic enough in my life? Are they preventing me from doing things that are important to me? Yes.
Yeah, and I would take the same approach to the side effects, particularly in somebody who's only tried one or two or maybe three medications, because there are so many options out there. It's very likely that another medication in the same class may be better tolerated.
Okay. So let's say someone's on meds, they've been trialing different pieces out, they've kind of found one that they work well on. They are in psychotherapy, they're doing ERP, they're doing like the cognitive work for OCD, and OCD is still resilient enough and it's sticking around. What are the options for folks like that, people in those positions?
Okay. So first off, there are certainly other drug therapy options we haven't covered. And maybe this podcast isn't the one to go in huge detail, but there are other kinds of drugs we use, such as antipsychotic medication, which I think is often confusing to people. But these are medications that just happen to work on other brain transmitter systems, specifically the dopamine system, in addition to serotonin. You'll hear serotonin coming up again and again. And these drugs can be very helpful as add-on medications or augmentation of antidepressants for OCD. There's also another class of medications that are increasingly a group of interest in research, which are medications that work on glutamate, yet another brain transmitter system, and some reasonable but still limited evidence that a number of drugs in that class can also help people as add-on drugs. So first of all, people should be trying multiple antidepressants and considering those add-on medications. I think something else to keep in mind is that even if people have an excellent family physician who's managed things really well while they tried their first three or four drugs, at some point around then, certainly by the fifth, if not earlier, it makes sense to seek out a specialist such as a psychiatrist, ideally someone who feels they have some familiarity with OCD, to get another opinion and just ensure, first of all, that OCD is the problem and that the medications being used are the best choices and have been used at appropriate dosages. So that's kind of my starting point before we talk about resistance.
Yeah, no, great points.
If somebody, however, has had good drug therapy, multiple drugs not working the way they would like, they've tried good CBT, they've given it their best, and they really aren't able to make those gains, that's when we begin to call it the illness treatment resistant. And fortunately, things are a lot better than they were 20 years ago for people in that position. So we actually have pretty good evidence that intensive CBT can work extremely well, even for people who have failed routine outpatient CBT. What do I mean by that? So there are a number of different definitions, but most people would say treatment that is at least twice a week. More commonly, though, we use it to refer to treatment in a hospital setting or as a day hospital patient. So whether or not you stay in a residential treatment setting or a hospital setting, or you're coming and going 5 days a week, 9 to 4 or 9 to 5, you're getting very intensive treatment at least 5 days of the week from a team that has more significant expertise in OCD. And this can work for actually the majority of people, even with resistant or refractory OCD, at least in terms of seeing some benefits, if not attaining remission. So that's number one. Now, there are a number of these centers in the US that can be a bit of a challenge for many people. Some provinces will cover that more readily than others. There's only one center in Canada. So I know this sounds perhaps a little like I'm beating on my own drum, but at the Thompson Center, we do run the only publicly funded intensive treatment program right now, where we offer both live-in care or day treatment, depending on the individual. And that is available to people from across the country at present. So that's one option. Beyond that, we get into other types of biological treatments, which can range from non-invasive to more invasive. So, for example, some of your listeners may have heard about repetitive transcranial magnetic stimulation. or deep transcranial magnetic stimulation, TMS is the acronym for these. And these are a form of treatment in which an individual is subjected simply to a high powered magnet over their head. Sounds pretty simple, pretty harmless, and it is. It's very safe. There are, of course, more specifics to it, but it turns out that a high-powered magnetic field over the head will induce changes in electrical activity in the underlying brain areas and change that brain activity in ways very similarly to the way medication and CBT affect changes in the brain. The catch with this is that although there is pretty good evidence for both RTMS and DTMS, at present, neither are funded publicly generally in Canada, which makes both very difficult to access other than privately.
Right.
So they are an option depending on your situation, whether you happen to live near a hospital that may be willing to give it to people with OCD despite not being funded for it, or if you are able to pay for private course of treatment, which can be quite costly. Just to be very clear, we're talking about 4 to 5 digits of funding needed for people.
Acknowledging like just the amount of barriers in place, like whether it's cost, availability, there's intersect on this too. How often would you say, like, what percentage of cases like warrant past the medication and psychotherapy component? Because I think that's an important piece to note there too.
Well, our best estimates are that at least 20 to 30% of people with OCD become treatment resistant. And so that's when I would say, first of all, think about more intensive CBT always, because that doesn't involve any risks. It is publicly funded, although limited accessibility right now. And that's a really great option for gaining those long-term skills. But otherwise, we then need to think about these options. Now, RTMS is lovely and DTMS is lovely. I will also point out that we don't have as much evidence about how helpful they are in people who have failed multiple previous treatments. There is limited evidence.
Okay.
After that, though, there are a couple of more invasive biological treatment options that I don't want to spend much time on today, but just to make your listeners aware that they exist. So the two major types of treatment we know that can work by directly changing the activity in the brain is something called a deep brain stimulation, or DBS for short, and psychosurgery.
Okay.
Now, in brief, DBS involves drilling two burr holes in the skull to drop two little thin wires called electrodes deep into the brain that are then connected to a controller device that's implanted on the chest wall, just like people have if they have a pacemaker for the heart. You could actually think of this as akin to a pacemaker for the brain circuit involved in OCD. And by changing the degree of stimulation and the type of stimulation, we can change again that electrical activity in that brain circuit. And about 70% of people with severe resistant OCD see some benefit. But this is long-term, it is invasive, and really requires regular follow-up and proximity to a center with advanced OCD expertise that offers this kind of care.
Right.
The last category of options I want to touch on are perhaps in some ways more frightening, maybe for some people less so. And that is what we call psychosurgery, by which we're talking about creating lesions in the brain circuit responsible for OCD. So again, our target is those same areas of the brain. The difference here is that traditionally it would be done by literally burning or cauterizing two very small specific lesions in the OCD circuit on each side of the brain. That's done in an operating room, one day, in and out. The wires don't remain. There's nothing that remains behind. But once those lesions are created, they are long lasting. Now, that has been around since the 60s in its contemporary form for OCD, but had significant side effects.
Right.
There are other methodologies that have been looked at, including what we call gamma knife irradiation, which uses a form of radiation that was developed, frankly, for people with inoperable brain lesions, for example, and allows us to still burn those areas of the brain with exposure to radiation, but without cutting into any tissue. That's also an option. And the most recent technology that is still emerging and being researched is something called focused ultrasound. And this is available at just a few sites around the world, Sunnybrook being one of them, in which individuals are basically exposed under live MRI imaging guidance. So we see the brain and its activity in real time to about 1,000 beams of ultrasound, which converge on a single spot and will raise the temperature in that spot to burn and create those lesions. So the same end result, but no cutting, no risk of an invasive surgery. And so far, the outcomes look excellent. So these are all means to a same end. Now, I want to just end with a brief caution about these, which is that all of these treatments, when I talk about, well, certainly deep brain stimulation and any form of psychosurgery, regardless of how it's done, typically right now we think of as treatments of last resort. These are never a starting point, and these should never be entertained lightly, and they should typically involve talking to a number of care providers with specific expertise in these treatments, because we want to reserve them for people for whom other less invasive options have been exhausted, but they do offer hope for that group of people.
Absolutely. It's such an aggressive range of different interventions that you've listed and shared, like in the last half hour here. It's really showcasing the importance of kind of going through the steps, looking at how those early interventions have the least amount of risk. And as you get into more treatment resistant territory, you're getting into more of that risky territory. We're still offering that hope and offering the different options. So really, really appreciate all this insight. One of the final questions I just want to ask, because you work in a center where you see a lot of that kind of treatment resistant OCD, for those that may be feeling a lot of hopelessness right now, that their OCD is unmanageable, that it's never going to get better, what are some words that you can share with them? What could you leave them with at this point?
Okay. I think that's a very important question, Mark. I'm so glad you asked that too. So I think, first of all, for anybody who feels they're in that situation, I want them to be sure that they are seeing a team with really deep expertise in OCD, and that, frankly, that they've sought out several opinions, not just one provider, whether it be me or any of my colleagues across the country like me, because any of us are capable of overlooking something and having a bit of tunnel vision. So you really want to make sure that nothing perhaps really helpful has been overlooked, and that the diagnosis is accurate, the treatment has been the best treatment possible.
Right.
After that, I want people to really give some thought to some of these more invasive treatment options I've mentioned. They do tend to be underutilized. Well, I think I've emphasized that we, you know, think of them and position them as treatments of last resort. The point is they are there. And I have seen some people make really substantial recoveries after receiving one of these types of treatments when everything looked hopeless. So that is also an option to consider. And thirdly, is that OCD is still a mystery. And we know that some people spontaneously over time will change. There are also other types of psychological treatment, which rather than targeting the OCD directly, may target focusing on having a good quality of life, even if OCD continues to be there. And while this may sound to some people like a pipe dream, it is not. I have seen these types of treatment work. And so I really do encourage people to think more broadly, to seek out those multiple opinions, and to think about some of these other treatment alternatives, and to always try to have some hope and focus on having the best quality of life and doing those things that give their life meaning, regardless of OCD.
Right. So we're seeing making sure you have a good team, making sure you have a team that has a lot of expertise, making sure you're getting those second opinions to make sure nothing's been overlooked, making sure that you don't negate those kind of more severe interventions if it warrants it, or if those professionals that you're working alongside with I think it would be a good intervention at that point. And also acknowledging that we do have a broad spectrum of different therapies, that even if traditional ERP and cognitive therapy for OCD may not be working wonders, kind of doing a little bit more like radical acceptance, value-based action, and living with some degree of OCD, even if it is leading to some dysfunction or a lot of distress, could still be very worthwhile as well.
Yes, exactly.
Peggy, thank you so much for your time today. You've given me so much to think about, and I'm sure our listeners. I think so much of this information is hard to be able to disseminate and to create in such a succinct way as you did today. So, really, from the bottom of my heart, thank you so much for being here, and we appreciate your time.
Thank you so much, Mark.
Thank you for listening to Our Anxiety Stories, the Anxiety Canada podcast. To share your own stories or to find resources and support this podcast, visit us at anxietycanada.com.